Welcome back to the KPL podcast. I'm your host, Jagisha. This week on the podcast, we talked to journalist Alex Marr about her book, 70 Times 7. This is the true story of the 1985 murder of a great-grandmother in Gary, Indiana. 15-year-old Paula was one of four teenage girls who invaded the home of a Bible teacher named Ruth. She was killed, and Paula was sentenced to death for the crime. The victim's grandson publicly forgave Cooper for the crime. The book provides details on Paula's life, as well as her victim Ruth's life, and even profiles on the prosecutor, Jack Crawford. So let's get started with the interview. I only had about 15 minutes to talk to Alex about her book.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
So jumping right in, please tell our listeners about the book.
So this is the story of a murder committed by a 15-year-old girl named Paula Cooper in Gary, Indiana, back in 1985. One afternoon, Paula and three other girls she went to school with, who were all 14, 15, 16 years old, they decided to skip class and they talked their way into the home of an elderly Bible teacher who lived nearby. The idea was to rob her for any valuables and cash. Something went horribly wrong that afternoon. Paula ended up striking the woman over the head and ultimately stabbed her several times, killing her. It was a crime that just shocked the city, Lake County, the state. Paula was sentenced to death in spite of being 15 at the time of the crime. And that death sentence actually ended up being picked up by the European press and creating a sensation around the world. There was just a shock at this news that a 15-year-old girl was on death row in America. Beyond that, a couple of months after her death sentence, Ruth Pelkey, the victim, her grandson, Bill, chose to publicly forgive Paula for taking the life of his grandmother. And that was against the wishes of his family, his friends, his congregation, his coworkers. He was truly alone in that moment in making that decision. And it ended up creating, you know, it set a lot of things into motion. And so that's really just the first part of the story. But the age, you know, Paula's age and the fact that she was sentenced to death so young, along with this forgiveness piece, you know, that the fact that the victim's grandson chose to forgive, those two elements really stopped me in my tracks. And I knew I needed to know more about this larger story.
Yeah. And it's an incredible story and something I hadn't heard about until I saw your book. So I think a lot of people probably might not have known about it, even though press has picked up. What about the title? The title has a great deal of significance and ties into what the story is really about, or what your book is really about. Could you explain the title?
70 times 7, I know for some readers will seem like a mysterious title at first. Mm-hmm. Others, they'll get the reference. It's in reference to a moment in the Bible that has a lot of meaning for one of the central characters in the book, Bill Pelkey. It's a moment where one of the disciples, Peter, asks Jesus, so, you know, essentially, are you saying that we should forgive people who wrong us, what, seven times? And Jesus says, no, I'm saying you should forgive 70 times seven. The idea being, I think, that you should be prepared to forgive any number of times, regardless of who has wronged you, how many times they've done so. And I think it's this incredible challenge that's being thrown down, because who can really live up to that, right? So when Bill Pelkey chooses to forgive Paula for killing his grandmother, that, to me, that's so radical. You know, he referred back to that passage in the Bible, and I thought, okay, well, so that's the debate then at the center of the book. You know, could you forgive? Should you forgive? What does it mean when we try to insert mercy into the justice process? So that's what the heart of this book is wrestling with.
So how did you first encounter the Paula Cooper case?
You know, I was doing some research more generally into the criminal justice system. I was looking in particular at violent crimes committed by women, since they're far more rare. And I found the murder of Ruth Pelkey, and everything else fell away. You know, as I mentioned before, Paula's age, the fact that you could still sentence someone so young to death in this country, and the forgiveness piece, all just made me realize I wanted to spend a great deal of time with this. I ultimately researched this book for about 5 years and spoke with something like 80 different people who had a connection to the case and how it moved through the courts, and how the issue moved through the courts. Mm-hmm. And I ended up going from Paula's situation, connecting the dots all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court case, Roper v. Simmons, in 2005, that finally ended the death penalty for kids in this country. But at the core of the book, from the very beginning, I knew it was going to be this relationship between Bill and Paula, because when Bill forgave her, he actually wrote her a letter and sent it to death row. And she wrote back. And it was the beginning of hundreds and even thousands of letters and emails over the years, a real relationship formed between them. And I was able to have access to that correspondence and the arc of that relationship, the emotional arc of that, the anger from Paula, you know, the struggle she was experiencing on death row as a young person, trying to figure out, you know, does this man want revenge? Why is he really writing me? And then ultimately accepting that he actually wants a relationship. All of that was just incredible to me. And it created this bridge between the families on either side of this terrible crime, where you don't usually see people reaching across the aisle. Mm-hmm. So to me, that was incredible to explore.
Yeah, it sounds like a very incredible process. To what degree did race play a role in Paula's crime, like when it was handled through the criminal justice system?
Well, so Paula was Black. Her victim, Ruth Pelkey, was white and also an elderly Bible teacher. You can imagine the press at the time in the 80s in an area that had a history of profound segregation. Mm-hmm. You can imagine the press really having a response to that. I think, you know, if it wasn't explicitly stated, it was definitely a large part of why this was seen as a sensational crime in the region. Glen Park, the neighborhood where Ruth Pelkey lived, had been an entirely white neighborhood, and that had just started to change. So this was seen as a crime that was symbolic of, you know, oh, the area is changing. What does this mean? It was a bit more complex than that, though, in that the judge who sentenced Paula to death was himself a Black judge, the first Black criminal court judge in the county and one of the only ones in Indiana. He was against the death penalty and felt forced by the law into giving the death sentence to this girl. And that was just a life-changing experience for him. I think that, you know, the larger picture too is one of the something that I mentioned about the death penalty in general, is that there's a bias built in. You're far more likely to receive the death sentence if the victim is white than if the victim is a person of color. You're far more likely to receive the death sentence as a person of color in various Southern states where there is a history of racial tension that's particularly pronounced. So that's in the background. I think that a lot of stories about our criminal justice system in this country end up having an important element of race baked in. And so I absolutely wanted to acknowledge that.
Yeah. And so the other part of this is the fact that Paula is also 15. So how does, what was important about, or the history of teenagers prosecuted in the country, and especially getting such a harsh sentence?
You know, what's incredible to me in doing this research is that, first of all, when Paula was sentenced to death and the press started to really focus on this, it came out that most Indiana residents were unaware that the state had on the books a minimum age of 10 years old for the death sentence. This was just an absolute shock to most Indiana residents who just were not aware of this fact, right? And so you had a law professor who was from Indiana, who was at Cleveland teaching there, who had started doing research into the history of the death sentence for juveniles in this country. He discovered that the data just had never been collected and publicized. And what he found is that in this country, we've executed more than 300 teenagers, under the age of 18. And since the 70s, we have sentenced to death more than 200 kids. So this is not some kind of colonial times problem. This is something that is actively a part of our culture. And so this professor, Victor Stribe, ended up actually getting on board for Paula Cooper's appeal and helped make her case in front of the Indiana Supreme Court. He ended up also arguing another really pivotal case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court and was part of a team that ended up bringing an end to this practice in 2005.
Okay. Now, one thing I don't fully understand is you said that the judge felt he was forced to make the decision. And I don't understand legalese and what the law is, but doesn't he have some amount of wiggle room in terms of how he goes about sentencing?
I think this is someone, who was a liberal, but he also really believed in trying to follow the word of the law as closely as possible. Paula's public defender did a very, very weak job. He took a guilty plea in a capital case with no deal on the table and just decided that, we have a judge who's gonna lean our way. Let's take our chances. And so the judge ultimately felt, I can't justify this on legal grounds, giving her a lesser sentence for this extreme crime. That same day, right after leaving the courtroom, having given the death sentence to this teenage girl, he called one of his appellate defenders into his office privately. I found this out. Like, this had not come out until I ended up speaking with this man decades later. But he called him into his office and he said, "Look, I can't live with what happened today. I'm putting you on her appeal. You have got to get this girl out of this situation." So I think his hope was also that somehow the system would find correct itself. So he was in a pretty complex situation. Mm-hmm. It was also, it was the 1980s, and it was really the beginning of the tough on crime Reagan era.
Yeah.
And even though the prosecutor was a Democrat, he was a tough on crime prosecutor. He had run on that kind of platform. There wasn't a single protest in Lake County when a teenage girl was sentenced to death. That was not something people were publicly offended by. It wasn't until the European press got upset and embarrassed us that we started having a debate in the US media about the meaning of this case. Mm-hmm. So that's also a really fascinating piece here. And, it went all the way up to the Vatican, where Pope John Paul II, through a spokesperson, made a statement, we should really get this girl off of death row. What's happening in America? So there we still have, of course, that tough on crime mindset in this country today. Mm-hmm. But back then it was, you didn't have as much dialogue and debate around it. Now we know, at least we have the research that proves that is not an approach that keeps our communities safe. Back then it just went unquestioned.
Yeah. Yeah. And every politician, I think, who got on TV said, "Oh, I'm tough on crime." So, and it was both sides. So yeah, it's
right. Right. And it was really, the other piece of this, too, is I really tried to speak to as many people who touched this case as possible. And so I got to know very well the prosecutor in Lake County, Jack Crawford, and kind of got into the psychology of his decision. Initially, they arrested these four teenage girls. He had a press conference right away and said, "I'm going to go for death for as many of these girls as I can." Effectively, he made that statement. Mm-hmm. And, even looking back at it today, he no longer believes in the death penalty. But he would not say that he would have done something differently back in 1985. So it was interesting to try to get into the mindset of someone who holds a role that powerful in our justice system, and how he justified his stance back then. It's not something he's at peace with at this point, but he won't admit to having made the wrong call. So I found that psychologically really fascinating.
Yeah, the mindset of the time period definitely is fascinating for a lot of the people that were involved in the case. So our time is up. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That's our show this week. Thank you for listening. Join us next week when we talk to Lisa Scottolini about her new historical novel, Loyalty. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Maya Angelou. It's one of the greatest gifts you can give yourself, to forgive. Forgive everybody. Until next time.